landscape land, or we call it narang, is everything. It's sort of part of us, and we're part of it. All our information, if you track it back, always comes back from the land. One of our students, or not student, he's a postgrad student, he's now naming in his, or his papers, he's naming the land or the landscape as a co-author. And I think that's beautiful because the land does tell you, it speaks to you. You know, not in the language that most people speak, but it does speak to you. You know what's going on when you see and hear and everything. And when you walk into a landscape, the landscape will tell you so much. Like the bellbirds, they tell us that this is under pressure because they only visit where, or they only come and live where inland this is under pressure. The ravens, scavengers, they don't kill, they scavenge. So again, that's another sign that the land is under extreme pressure. And the weeds that are coming in, they don't belong. And normally the landscape itself would have taken care of those weeds. But there's not enough. So we know that this is not a healthy land, and we've got it in our hands to make it, to return it to health again. Those becerias, that's another sign of a very unhealthy landscape. They are a medicine plant, and that's the landscape trying to heal itself. They're a remarkable plant. It's a wonderful relationship. Just in the early winter, when there's no other plants flowering, they produce really heavy nectar-bearing flowers, and it attracts a little flightless, or the female of this wasp species is flightless. It attracts her, she comes up, she drinks the nectar out of the flowers, and then she produces a pheromone that attracts the males. And the males fly in, mate with her. She then falls down to the ground and she wanders around until she hears the noise or the sound of the cut-leaf moth larvae moving through the soil. So she burrows down and lays her eggs in the larvae. Now those eggs hatch out and eat the larvae from the inside out. If that larvae wasn't eaten, it would come up, burrow its way up to the surface, and then it would turn into the cut-leaf moth, which actually eats the growing tips of the eucalypts. But the larvae itself feeds on the growing tips of the roots of the eucalypts. So it's killing the tree from both ends. And that little bush growing there tells us that there's so many of them that we need more moths to come in and help the eucalypts. So that, and then the eucalypts itself, they have a mycorrhizal fungus in their sap which travels around the whole tree. It eventually accumulates in the leaves. When the leaves fall down to the ground like there, they start to decay. The mycorrhizal fungus then migrates from the decaying leaves to the roots of the plants growing underneath the eucalypt. They attach themselves to the roots of those plants and enable them to take up the nutrients that they need to produce the medicines that we use. All you can see is little bubbles, big bubbles, of activity, and they're all joined together. And I remember one time when I was at uni, I was studying sharks, because when I was a little kid, Mum took me down to Cook's River and she said, look at the water. So I looked at the water and there's all these sharks in the water and they're just laying on the bottom. In those days you could see the bottom of Cook's River. And she said, what are they doing? I said, Mum, they're just sunbaking. And she said, no, look closer. I looked closer and the fish hanging on to the bellies of the sharks were dropping off. And when all the fish had dropped off, the shark had turned around and go back out to sea. But the fish that dropped off were swimming upstream. And she said to me, now, don't you ever forget that. You remember it. So I did. Then later on, I'd been taken away three or four times, and then I came back another time, and she took me down to the Georges River at Liverpool Weir. And it was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen. The eels were coming over that weir, and they were so thick in the river, you felt you could walk across on their backs. It was amazing. And she said, "What's happening?" And I said, "Oh, Mum, look at all the eels." You know. And she said, "What are they doing?" And I said, "Oh, they're coming over the weir." And she said, "Yes. What else?" And they'd swim around for a little bit, and then they'd go out down the river. And I said, "Oh, they're going down to the river." She said, "Where are they going?" And I said, "To Botany Bay." "Where does Botany Bay lead?" "Oh, to the sea, Mum." She said, "Good, remember that, because one day you might need it." And so that puzzled me. So I thought, well, it began with the sharks. So when I get to uni, I'll study sharks, which I did. And I was up on Heron Island studying the shark. Oh, beautiful creatures. Studying the sharks. And I would spend a whole 24 hours down just watching the sharks. It was wonderful, particularly on a full moon night, you know. And I had a hooker system. They were testing the hooker systems in those days where you could stay down for 24 hours. Anyway, so I studied them. And then I was talking to one of the other scientists, and I was telling him about the eels and the suckerfish. And he said, "Well, why don't you see what joins them all up?" He said, "Because I can show you one of the joins." I said, "Okay." And we got the Matthew Flinders, which was an oceanographic scientific vessel, and we went out to the Coral Sea. And there, in the Coral Sea, were all the eels, and they were spawning and eating the dead and dying eels with the sharks. So when I came back to Sydney, I thought, okay, I'll wait till the time of the Waratah, and I'm going to go up to the headwaters and find out where the suckerfish go. So I went up to the Nepean, to the headwaters of the Nepean at that time, and there were the suckerfish spawning and dying, and waiting to eat them were the eels. So we got the circle of the eucalypts, we got the circle of the sharks. We're not studying enough. You know, we're going in looking at little pieces through a microscope, when what we should be doing is studying the whole. I've always, when I've made a major discovery that's joined a whole lot of dots together, I've given myself a bubble bath. And every single one of my bathrooms has had a glass ceiling. The present one has a glass ceiling. So you can lay in the bathtub in the sunlight and look at the trees and the sky and everything. But this time I was looking at the bubbles. And I was just looking at the bubbles, and I saw this really beautiful coloured little bubble. And I thought, oh, isn't that pretty? I'd like a necklace of that, you know. And the bubble burst. And then all the other bubbles around it filled in the hole. But when they did that, they lost some of their colour. And they burst. And then the ones outside filled in that hole. And that's our environment. You take away one little piece, it mightn't even be an important piece, or apparently important piece. You take away one little piece and it affects the whole environment, because pretty soon I had no more bubbles in my bubble bath. The whole thing was that's like our environment. It's a bubble bath where all these little tiny compartments all fit together beautifully, all beautifully coloured, and then one breaks and it's all gone. And I keep thinking, we need to keep those little bubbles. Those little bubbles are important. And yeah, so that started me on my search, and then started me on my wish to teach, because I've written off my generation and the next generation and generation after that, teaching the kids, and perhaps they can save this planet and we won't have to move to Mars. My father always told me I was an alien from another planet. Because I always did things wrong, or backwards, or differently to everybody else. Internally, my landscape was different. Well, I used to be extremely bad-tempered, but I've softened in later years. And I used to be I've matured, ripened. That's a better word. I have ripened. Yeah. And become more tolerant. My internal landscape is one of peace and tranquility, except when I really get mad, and then everybody dives for cover. The smell I love most of all, of course, is Boronia. Right? Boronia's up here, right? That's the epitome. That's what I want to be. But it can never be. My most favourite smell is the smell of the native frangipani, which incidentally happens to be my traditional tree. Because when a female is born into our family, the native frangipani is always planted. The seed is always planted for them. So we have a long line of native frangipanis in various places that are related to us. And so it's a very faintly beautiful smell of frangipani, but not as strong. The Aboriginal knowledge is based on observation and experience, right? The scientific, and that's scientific anyway, and the scientific knowledge, the present day modern science knowledge, is of experimentation and measurement. You put the four together and you have a whole science. And this is what I'm trying to get them to do. I've succeeded sometimes. If you had all of those sciences working together for the good of the planet and therefore the good of the humans, well, the good of everything on it, I don't think we're very good. Shangri-La, heaven, our heaven, earthly heaven. Yeah. And that's what it would be. You know, we would know everything about the earth. We would know everything about the how everything links together. Or we'd be well on the way to knowing everything. I don't think we could know everything because things change. Yeah, and changes all the time and develops and then changes back again. Mum had an uncle, he was a lovely old man, and he was about 90 when I first met him. And he told me a whole lot of things, but one of the things he told me was, the earth will live forever, but we've got to help it. See, we regard the earth as a mother. The landscape is just part, maybe it's the skin of a bottom, or maybe it's the sole of a foot, or maybe it's the top of a head. So we've got to look after it, because she's our mother. We're made of the earth. Darawal.